across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! The camera to the right, they tell me. Hello there, we're talking about winter fuel payments today. Gordon Lyons, the Communities Minister, announced late on Friday afternoon that they would be cut for pensioners here. And we're hearing noises from other parties in the executive. Well, we have no choice. This is big bad Keir Starmer. Well, that is one argument, because once he decided, the Prime Minister decided to do that for England and Wales, that means that Northern Ireland automatically loses that amount of money. But it's not true that this was Sir Keir Starmer's decision. This was a Stormont decision made here in Northern Ireland. So did they talk it through? Mike Nesbitt seems to say they did. He said they got close to some sort of workaround. But what was that? Can any of us be enlightened? How much did they actually fight to protect some more pensioners that just sit outside those that entitlement to those benefits? And what impact will this have on people who desperately needed that 300 quid? All coming up this morning on Nolan. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, welcome to the Nolan Show. Oh, it's terrible what the big bad British government have done. They have cut the winter fuel allowance. No, they haven't, for pensioners here in Northern Ireland. Stormont has taken the devolved decision to cut the winter fuel allowance. That is what has happened. It was a local decision by locally accountable politicians. The statement was released around 3:30, 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon by the Communities Minister, Gordon Lyons. Now look, Gordon had a difficult decision to make, but it was his decision in consultation with the local executive here. There's not much money. So had they not cut the winter fuel allowance for pensioners, they would have had to find that money from somewhere else, take it off other services. But it was their decision. So when you hear party after party in that local executive this morning, in this news cycle, talk about the big bad British government, this was a Stormont decision. And when you hear them talking about they were threatened that they would be kicked off the UK-wide IT system that delivers these payments to you, the benefit system, in other words, remember that they knew about it for over 30 days. So the Stormont politicians have known about this for over a month. What I want to know this morning is, did they hold, if they were so concerned and if they are so angry on behalf of politicians, was there any summit called where all the political parties got together and urgently discussed this? Was August too inconvenient for them to do that? Were they on beaches or summer holidays or off? Now, if they did have those meetings, did you feel or hear about any public debate around this? This could be the right decision to make. It might have been nigh on impossible for them to find the money to preserve winter fuel payments for pensioners. Indeed, you could argue very strongly that all pensioners should not get the winter fuel allowance because some of them don't need it. But when you're hearing this attempt by Stormont to level this at the British government, remember that this was a devolved decision. The DUP minister, Gordon Lyons, announced the decision on Friday. He was on Even Extra the same day.
We've really been left in the position of having no decision to make. In a way, there was no choice for us. And in fact, the government said to us if they didn't have a decision from us today, that then they would be forced to remove Northern Ireland from their IT system altogether, and that there would be no payments made to anybody this winter, regardless of whether you were qualified in England. Well, it absolutely was. And what's frustrating for me is that we have had no time to consider how then we could best help those who are most in need.
You had a month, Gordon. You knew about this from the end of July. And in terms of you saying that the British government forced your hand, that you had no time to sit down and discuss the decision, what did you say back? What has our executive said collectively back to the British government, who threatened to boot every pensioner off that system and give the executive, according to Gordon Lyons, you've got a day to decide or we're booted. These politicians are tough when they need to be. The DUP, Sinn Féin, the Alliance Party, the Ulster Unionist Party, look how toxic, look how feisty politics is in Northern Ireland. These politicians are fighters. So when that was threatened on this country, that is a story that should not go unnoticed. What is our reaction? How did our politicians stand up for us, threatening to boot us off the computer system? 03030 80 55 55. Apparently we were down a number of phone answers today until 10 o'clock, so we might be slow to answer your calls today, but we'll do our best. Please be patient with us. I've been speaking to the Ulster Unionist Party MLA, Andy Allen, for his reaction.
Well, I think it was an inevitable decision coming from the executive, Stephen. It's a decision that we didn't want them to be taking, but we knew the context of the difficult budget landscape that Northern Ireland has. So I do think it was inevitable. And that is why I wrote to the Prime Minister at the beginning of last week, urging his government and highlighting, firstly, the consequences of this awful decision being taken by the UK government, but also urging that they review the minimum income guarantee of pension credits so that we can ensure that more of the most vulnerable households, low-income households, can be captured within pension credit.
You're all at this, that it was inevitable. It was a stormont decision. So where was the public debate by politicians around this? How was it inevitable? Where were the discussions around revenue raising in order to mitigate some of the change here if you all wanted to do so? Where were the decisions? Well, look, we'll not go as far as GB, but we'll protect some more pensioners than are protected in England, Scotland and Wales. You're all at this. It was inevitable. It was not inevitable, was it?
Well, firstly, Stephen, I don't know what you mean by we're all at this. Poverty and the impacts of poverty is something that I've highlighted from day one from getting involved in politics, and I will continue to highlight. Fuel poverty is something that I've highlighted and continue to highlight, and I will do all that I can to ensure that those most vulnerable in our society, their voices are heard, and we do all that we can to try to support them. But the reality of the situation we have in front of us is this decision came out of left field, and I'm by no means an apologist for the executive. Have we got everything right? Absolutely not. But in this instance, it came out of left field. We didn't know it was coming.
It was over a month ago.
In terms of the decision, yes.
It was announced by the British government over a month ago. I'm hearing Minister Gordon Lyons say today that we didn't have much notice. There was a month. Were there too many politicians on holiday? Were there too many politicians sitting on a beach somewhere rather than getting home and thinking about this for the pensioners who desperately need this money?
Well, Stephen, it's something that's been on the forefront of my mind since it was announced. But the reality of it is when we talk in the context of not having much time, there wasn't a massive amount of time in terms of the notification that was provided by the UK government in regard to this decision. Yes, the executive had a month, and I don't know what different variables the Department for Communities were looking at, but the fundamental reality of it is it appears that it comes down to cost, and it's important that we speak with a collective voice in putting back that message to the UK government, and that's why I have highlighted, and this is an important matter, Stephen, and it should not get lost in this debate. We need to be looking and pushing the UK government at increasing the minimum income guarantee for pension credit.
Go ahead. Finish your point, Andy. Sorry.
It's a very important point because that would ensure then that we end up in a position whereby we capture more of the most vulnerable pensioners within the current policy change that's being taken forward by the UK government. Is it a policy change that I wanted to see come? No, absolutely not. Is it a policy change that I would have taken forward? No, absolutely not. But it is the reality of where we are, and we need to be open and honest with the public in that regard.
Local government, local responsibility. Are you aware of any conversations where it was considered to make unpopular revenue-raising decisions? Whether it was even weighed up, okay, we'll ask those with the broadest shoulders in Northern Ireland to pay more. Maybe it's lifting a cap on the rates bill for those people that are sitting in million-pound houses. I don't know. Maybe it's prescription charges. Maybe it's water rates. Are you aware of those discussions that went, did they go on in order to consider whether this had to be done to pensioners in Northern Ireland?
Well, Stephen, I think firstly the conversation is not as simplistic as that, and we need to analyse all of that revenue raising in the context of what is the additional impact that that would have on people. But it is an important conversation, and it is a conversation.
Did it happen over the last month?
No, Stephen, let me finish my point, please. It is a conversation that we need to have, and it is an important conversation that the executive needs to front up to. I'm not a member of the executive, so I don't know. I'm not privy to those detailed conversations that may have gone on, so I don't know what conversations they had in this context, but I don't think we can discuss that in isolation of, well, if we revenue raise, we need to look at what impact that then would have on those people that will be impacted by this decision regarding their fuel payment.
Absolutely. But when I'm getting up out of bed this morning and I'm hearing across the news cycle this united message from the executive all week, not our fault, all Sir Keir Starmer's fault. This is a local decision made by a local minister supported by other executive parties, including yours. So you have decided, the Ulster Unionist Party, the DUP, Sinn Féin, the Alliance Party, in that executive, you have decided to cut winter fuel payments for pensioners. It was your decision. That's called devolution.
The UK government decided to cut this. This is the policy change that they took forward. This is an annually managed expenditure policy that is delivered. They took away the funding in the wider context
they
of
did.
That and left the executive in a position already on a difficult budget landscape of where were we going to find the additional money to fund this. And absolutely, I'm more than happy to say on your show here today, I would have much preferred that we were in a position that the Department for Communities were announcing that we were looking at mitigating. But where do we take that money from, Stephen, in that regard, in terms of, and this is the point that I'm making, the very short time, and I know you highlight a month, but that is a very short time in the context of the difficult budget landscape that we have in terms of this. And it's an appalling
decision. I didn't
hear
about emergency meetings where all of the parties in the executive scrambled together, sat down, held a summit over the last month to consider this. Did you?
Well, Stephen, I'm telling you what I've done and what I've been highlighting. I've written to the Prime Minister to encourage and urge him to bring forward that policy change of increasing the minimum income guarantee of pension credit so that we can capture more of the most vulnerable pensioners within pension credit with this policy change being taken forward by the UK government. That would be a massive change, and that would have a significant impact on the wider context of people that we're talking about. And you keep highlighting and saying, you know, what are the executives doing or what are others doing? I'm telling you exactly what I've done. I have written to the Prime Minister encouraging and urging. And if we look at analysis done, such as the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, in which they highlight the minimum income standard required, and we're talking about an income for people to be able to live with dignity, not an income of just existing. And it would highlight that the current pension credit income threshold is below where it should be. And that is what I'm arguing with the Prime Minister and the UK government, that they should increase that. But also equally, we need to be making sure that more of those pensioners who are entitled to pension credit are claiming it. And it's important that those who feel that they may have an entitlement or maybe don't know that they have an entitlement, reach out to the Department for Communities Make the Call service on 0800 232 1271. Or alternatively to that, we have a number of amazing advice organisations right across Northern Ireland. It's important that individuals, whether it be pensioners or others, obviously we're talking about pensioners in the context of this change, this appalling change, but it's important that people reach out for advice. And it's also important that when we're talking about Social Security, that we destigmatise the culture around Social Security and recognise it as the important safety net that it is for individuals and families.
Okay. Andy, what do you say to pensioners who are struggling?
Well, what I would say in this instance is that I and my party and others will continue to fight for them. I'm going to continue to press the UK government on the point that I've highlighted around increasing the minimum income guarantee for pension credit. And then equally, I'd be highlighting that it's important that they reach out for that advice and guidance around what they may be entitled to. And also then, as a third, the Northern Ireland Executive need to be looking at what short-term support measures we can put in place. And then that medium to longer term piece around the fuel poverty strategy and how we can lift households out of fuel poverty.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed, Andy, for talking to us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
Harry's our first caller then, Donna Clooney. Morning, Harry.
Hello there.
Go ahead, sir.
I'm complaining about this pension credit because the list of benefits that people can get pension credit, most of the pensioners are not in it. If you have worked all your days and paid your taxes, you're not likely to be suitable for pension credit. And as far as these politicians down in Stormont are concerned, that man just after said he wrote to the Prime Minister. What good is that writing to the Prime Minister? Why is the First and Second Ministers not standing at the doors of Westminster this morning, beating the door down?
Well, and how did the First Minister, the Deputy, how did Michelle O'Neill react? Our First Minister and our Deputy First Minister, Emma Little-Pengelly, how did they react when we hear from Gordon Lyons that we were threatened, that this country was essentially threatened, that we would be booted off the IT system within a day? Like, again, I switched on the radio this morning and I said, what? Within a day? Did they stand up and say to them, you will not do that? Was this executive united? Or did we roll over and say, oh, well, we need to panic then?
Well, that's all they are. Stormont has turned into just a messaging service for Westminster. I do a lot of voluntary work. There's lots of pensioners who do voluntary work. They don't get anything for it, but they go and do it anyway. But the only thing they do get is a winter fuel allowance. I'm actually going to get a tooth out next week down the Lisburn Road or somewhere. People tell me it's going to cost me £150. I'm paying out for everything, and even a family member got an operation there. They paid for it too. Pensioners are paying for everything.
Well, as our struggling families, as our working people, as our young people, Harry, and there is a legitimate debate as to whether pensioners should be given special treatment and what's wrong with means testing so that pensioners who don't need it don't get it.
I know, but the point about the means testing is most of the pensioners don't qualify for it. It's a very small thing for to get it. You have to be a universal credit income support or something. It doesn't take into account people paying rent and such like. As long as they pay it, everybody's happy. But you take the rent, take the cost of your electric and your cost of your gas every week. Even the cost of car insurance has gone up this year. Pensioners are getting beat at everything.
Well, and you think working people aren't?
Well, they're not. I don't know. I worked all my days myself, so I didn't complain. I paid my taxes. I'm just talking about pensioners.
What do you say to the...
A lot of pensioners live on their own, remember.
What do you say to the executive this morning who are essentially saying to you all it's not their fault?
No. I don't agree with that. There's always an excuse for pissing the bed, and they use it all the time. It's always somebody else's fault. We heard John Swinney at the SCP conference yesterday. He said the people voted the Conservatives out because they were fed up with austerity. Now they're going to get super austerity.
Harry, thank you. Morning to you. Obviously, we apologise for the language. Eddie Lynch, Commissioner for Older People. Morning to you, Eddie.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Are you aware, as the Commissioner for Older People, given the fact that the executive have known about this for a month, did the political parties in the executive sit down together and hold any emergency meetings to discuss the options here?
Well, Stephen, I am not aware of the ins and outs of what meetings took place. What I am aware of that this decision from the UK government really came out of the blue a month ago, caught us all in the hop. It wasn't something that the Labour Party had in their manifesto. It's something that has come out that has been introduced very quickly. And it is a disgraceful decision that is going to have real-life consequences for thousands of older people across Northern Ireland who really rely on the winter fuel payment. This is not something that they can take it or leave it. It's something that they rely on to get through the winter months, and they plan on getting it. And for this announcement to be made literally a couple of months before people are due to receive this payment is disgraceful. And it's really the government targeting some of the most vulnerable in society as the first recipients of the cuts.
Politicians, some politicians can claim for a heating allowance, can't they? I need to look into the detail of that. I look at that, Eddie, and we'll see what the detail is around that. You say that some pensioners, this will push them over the edge. Are those pensioners not protected by this current policy? This revised scheme will give winter fuel payments to people on income support, income-based job seekers allowance, income-related employment and support allowance, state pension credit, universal credit.
Well, we've talked about it. I've been on your show many times talking about universal benefits, and there's a reason they exist, Stephen. It's because means testing doesn't work. Because it doesn't work because it doesn't get the support to many thousands of people who are entitled to it. And there are many barriers that people who should be entitled to pension credit. The reality is a lot of them don't get it for various reasons. But there's also a large number of older people in Northern Ireland who sit just above that threshold of being able to qualify for pension credit. And those are people on low incomes who really rely on this winter fuel payment to get through the winter months. I think it's really important, Stephen, to point out that there is a reason why the winter fuel payment exists. And that reason is that the UK pension is one of the lowest in Europe. And it was recognised decades ago by the British government that they needed to give this extra payment for older people just to stay warm during the winter. So we are talking about serious real-life consequences as a result of this being removed.
Not for everybody, though, Eddie. Pensioners, no matter what their income, no matter whether they were multimillionaires or not, were getting this money. Was it right for Labour to at least change that?
My view on this always has been the same, Stephen. If an older person or anyone doesn't need the money, my advice was very simple, to donate that to charity, to give it to an older people's organisation, to give it to a fuel poverty organisation, because that means it reaches the people who are in desperate need. We are talking about people, some of the most vulnerable, Stephen, sitting in their houses during the winter months, really worrying that they're going to get through the winter months. And unfortunately, we know from the statistics that many don't. Many fall sick, many get ill, and many die as a result of the cold.
Mike Nesbitt, our health minister, has said on Gamoo this morning that this decision will impact on the health service here in Northern Ireland. In other words, he's expecting people to get sick and need either doctor or hospital treatment because of this Stormont decision.
This decision to means test the winter fuel payment will lead to more older people in our hospitals, in our emergency departments. And we know already the stresses and the strains that our hospital system and our health services are under. And that always gets worse in the winter months. But this decision will make things worse. So it will not just affect, you know, the people themselves who are affected. It will affect everyone in society who needs the health service and needs emergency services.
And are you telling me, just to double back on one of my initial questions so I can be crystal clear about this, you're the Commissioner for Older People in Northern Ireland. Are you telling me the Executive did not, and Gordon Lyons did not, consult with you or have a conversation with you before making this decision?
Well, I wrote to Minister Lyons when this decision from the UK government came out. I did ask him to consider other options to see whether the hole could be plugged in some way. I got a response to that, which was basically saying, unfortunately, it looks like we can't find this extra money with the current budget. And I do understand the pressures on the budget here locally. I have heard about a lot of services that are being cut back that are affecting not just older people, but many others in society. So this is something that is being removed by the UK government. This is money that comes from the UK government, and it is being sprung on our local assembly with very little notice, with no consultation. But it's not given a chance. That this government, if they want to stand by this decision, should at least have given a period of consultation to allow all of us who know what this means for older people to go back to them and to give the reasons why this is a flawed decision. This decision could still be stopped, but you know, this government doesn't seem interested at the minute in hearing about the negative impact that this will have.
Eddie, thank you. That's Eddie Lynch, Commissioner for Older People. Mary's in Lurgan. Morning, Mary.
Morning, Stephen. Stephen, I just wanted to say to you that, right, you've lived long enough in this world to be a pensioner. You're entitled to get that fuel allowance. I mean, whether you live on your own, whether there's 2 years, you still need to heat the house. The winter months come in very, very quickly. It's starting to get cold today. Jesus, you would need the oil man today, really and truly. But I mean, see this talk about there's always money, Stephen. When they need to get money, they can go and get it.
Well, Stormont have made a range of decisions, and to be fair to them, they are protecting people by doing it, but they have made a range of decisions to rule out revenue raising, a number of different revenue raising measures. They've made those decisions. So that is money that, that could have been extra into the pot to pay for things like this or to give them the discretion where to distribute it. They have not lifted the cap on rates. They have not brought in prescription charges. They have ruled out water rates. So these are political decisions by a local government, Mary. Not by the British government. These are local devolved decisions by the political parties here.
But Stephen, whenever your day comes and you become a pensioner, and it comes in very, very quickly, I never ever thought that I would be a pensioner, believe you me, and to sit and have to do the things that I do. Never in my younger days would I ever have thought of getting an oil tank come to the door or worrying about the price of oil. This is something that we have earned, Stephen. This is a serious thing. They need to, if they're not going to give it to those people on the benefit that they're entitled to, well, are they going to give them another alternative payment? This is what I would like to know. They're going to have to give something to the elderly people. And see this talk about the rich ones that don't need to get it. If they have earned it and lived up to that age, they're entitled to get it, Stephen. Well, whether they want to go and drink it or not.
This word entitlement in a period where our services are stretched to the point of some of them stretched to the point of collapse. Then can pensioners like you talk anymore about just because you've worked all your life, you're entitled to it? People are entitled to get off waiting lists. Kids are entitled to a proper education in school, in proper buildings. And is it not just too easy for pensioners like
Stephen,
you, Mary, to talk about entitlement?
I am entitled. I think I've learnt enough in Northern Ireland and I've done my bit for Northern Ireland that I think I'm entitled to get it, and it's not being selfish, it's not being anything. I think it's just a great thing to come to someone at that age in life,
okay,
that they can get it.
Mary, thank you. 030 30 80 55 55. It's very reactive this morning. We'll pause there, get the news from the BBC. Brendan Mulgrew, commentator, former special advisor up on Stormont. Good morning to you, Brendan.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. You reckon the executive had no choice?
I don't envy the executive the situation that was, in this case, forced upon them. I don't think they had a choice but to pass on the UK government decision to our Winterfield.
Like, it's quite literally not true that they didn't have a choice. They did have a choice.
But nor is it true, Stephen. You've sort of been portraying this morning as if the UK government decision didn't lead to the decision was needed to be taken locally, which it did. If the UK government hadn't taken the decision to means test with the fuel payments, our executive wouldn't have had to make a decision on it.
Sorry, you're 100% right. But the bottom line is, despite how they're trying to portray it, this was an executive decision. This was a decision by Stormont.
Yeah, Stephen, I criticise the executive when it's fair and when they need to be constructively criticised. But in parallel with what you've just said, without the UK government decision, the situation didn't arise. In this case, it did. Now, I think that Gordon Lyons and co. should have made their decision a lot earlier. The Scottish government announced almost a month ago that they would be following the UK government's line on this, which means that their pensioners knew a month earlier that they had to plan for winter without their winter fuel payments, if that was the case. I think we were too slow to make the decision, but I think that inevitably the right decision has been made, because by the rough calculations, to have maintained across-the-board payments for all of our pensioners was going to cost around 70 million quid. And as a, you know, if I was a pensioner on a waiting list, I think that my sense of entitlement would more to be to receive hospital treatment than to get winter fuel payment or a free bus journey.
Sorry, the logic of what you're saying, you're 100% right. So look, if this was being presented to the Northern Irish public this morning as we had a tough decision to make, we could have either taken 70 million out of the health budget, or we could have taken that 70 million out of the education budget, and therefore that is why we decided to cut the winter fuel allowance for these pensioners. 100%, Brendan. But that's not what the executive have been saying. They are portraying this as this is the big bad British government. This is Stormont, hard political choices. And I still would like to know, Brendan, if they sat down and weighed all this up and chatted it through and what how long those meetings were and how much in depth they went to before they took this money off these pensioners.
Yes, Stephen, my sense of it would be, and there was an equally controversial decision last week around access to puberty blocker medications and treatment. My sense is that there was no collective meeting of the executive. They weren't round a table. I don't think they have been since the immigration protests/riots, over a month ago. I think this is probably done by correspondence and by executives signing off sort of verbally or in writing. I don't think if there had been a meeting of the executive to discuss all of this, surely we would have known about that. There would have been public statements about that.
So are pensioners not important enough for an executive to have some type of summit or meeting at least before this winter fuel payment was taken away from them locally?
Well, I think the executive as a whole has had not a great summer. I think we should have heard more from them across the board, particularly at times when there was literally riots on our streets. We needed more leadership then. I wouldn't portray the executive as being, unthinking of pensioners, because I do think that they haven't sat around the table to thrash all of this out. They would have come to the same conclusion. I just wish that the interview that Gordon Lyons gave on Friday night, and I wouldn't criticise much about it, I think it should be given a month earlier so that we all had a month longer to prepare for all of this, because I think the decision that has been reached was always going to be the decision.
And then the other story, I nearly fell out of bed this morning when I heard this, that it has been suggested, both Gordon Lyons said it on Friday, Mike Nesbitt said it again today on Good Morning Ulster, about how we basically had no choice and we would be booted off this computer system, and that was essentially the threat from the British government. Let's hear what Mike said, our Health Minister Mike Nesbitt. Let's hear what he said in Kabul this morning.
Well, I was devastated, as was every member of the executive, with the decision, which came absolutely left field. Nobody here, I think, had any warning of what the government were going to do. I think there was a good collective effort to try and find some sort of workaround, but that was not possible. And the fact is, because of the computer systems, if we didn't make a decision now, we would have been dropped off. Nobody here would have got the winter fuel payment. So we have written collectively, every single member has signed the letter, every single member of the executive, to the Prime Minister, to say that while we accept we're going to have to maintain parity, we are very, very unhappy about it.
So I have heard that right. So the British government threatened to drop every pensioner off the winter fuel payment. Brendan, again, those fiery, feisty politicians that can fight when they need to, did they tell the British government where to go with that level of threat?
Well, I suppose their IT...
Don't threaten this country. Don't dare do that. Did they do it? Did Michelle O'Neill do it? Or Gavin Robinson? Or Emma Little Pengelly?
No, I think it's I don't want to sound as if I'm dismissing that. It's almost a little bit of a sideshow, Stephen, because had they made this decision a month ago, or when the UK government first of all made the decision, again, the issue of, well, we're going to have to decouple you from IPs, there probably is. I'm not an IT expert or a social security expert. There probably is a UK-wide IT system. And if we were going to deviate from the UK government decision, then they probably
would. But it wasn't a sideshow to Gordon Lyons, our communities minister, because he brought it up and said, look, that's our little time that they were given. James and Temple Patrick. Morning, James.
Morning, Stephen. I think we first of all need to look at pensioners. We've had the WASPI women. And then you look at what the actual pension is. And if you work it out at an hourly rate, it's about £5 an hour for a pensioner. So if they're expected to survive on that, and many pensioners live alone, they've still got a house to run, they've still got bills to pay, then we have seriously got to look at our Stormont ministers and say, what are you going to do to help the pensioners? Now, I agree they won't make the tough decisions on rates, but there are other ways to raise money. And they need to sit round a table and be grown up and really start to think about how do we fund what we need to do here. And they're just not prepared to do it.
James, thank you. George in Guildford. Morning, George.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, I'd be on for a bit if I could, because I wouldn't The lack of you now, if you were 65 tomorrow, I wouldn't give it to you, and I wouldn't have given, but the bond is too high. I mean, the way they're doing it is the people that's on tax credit, but there's an awful lot of people just above that bond that are not any better off. They're not even as well off as the people on tax credit.
So did your executive...
They're the ones that's going to be hit the hardest.
So did your Stormont executive, did those political parties that form that executive, did they sit down, if they can't afford the 44-odd million, if they can't afford the 70 million, could they have afforded a smaller amount to protect some people that just sit outside the entitlement? Did they discuss it? Did they analyse it, George?
But then, Stephen, you must know that we're ruled. I mean, if you're the boss in a place, you make the decisions. And if I'm your number two, I have to do what you tell them at the bottom of the... England's fed up with us. They're sick, so tired of us because we're only a drain on everything they have. But then again, what about this Prime Minister that said all these things that he wouldn't do? And he's standing up in suits that I don't know many thousands of pounds, and he's lost it that I don't know many thousands of pounds. And then Arlene Foster, she says that the MPs in Westminster are not getting half enough.
George, thank you. Thomas and Cullyhanna. Morning, Thomas.
No, I think that the government is just targeting the vulnerable people that are pensioners, and the pensioners are taking this lying down. And the same to organise themselves are taking up protests in towns and cities against this shocking thing they've done. The people that does very little, I have £199 per week. I live out in the country, and I must have a car to get about. And Gordon Lyons and is saying sorry, and that will not fill up your tank. Like, I just get mad when I hear any of these politicians saying they're sorry about this.
Well, they're saying they're against it. They took the decision to do it, but said they're against it. They said they had no alternative, Thomas, because the money's not there.
I know, but there's money for everything else. To give doctors another 5% there lately, on top of what they got before that. And teachers got a big raise, and nurses and all professionals. They're treating the pensioners as complete dirt in this country, because the Dublin government can give them a double pension in the winter time, and this has been the worst summer for cold that I've seen in a long time. The heating had to be on every evening.
Are you going to be in difficulties this winter?
Yes, I'm going to be in difficulty. I can't put on the heating, just only about an hour at night. And I have a lot of sticks, so it's not so bad. I can light a fire all right. But there's other people like in worse difficulty. But if you're living on £199 and pay your rates and pay your insurance and run a car, it can't be done. They could have done this. I do a self-assessment because of a very small farm here, and they could have done this by looking at what your accountant come up with, what much you've made in the year. That would be a very simple thing for the authorities to do.
What do you say to Stormont this morning, Gareth? Do you think they're fighting for you enough?
They don't give one damn about... They're sitting up in a nice warm place all winter, and they don't care about us. And something should be done. Eddie Lynch should have some organised protests in Newry and that Belfast and other big towns.
Minister,
and I'll be the first at it if it's in Newry.
Thomas, thank you for your call today. Minister Lyons' statement says the Northern Ireland Act generally means social security benefits are paid at the same rates and within the same conditions of entitlement across the UK. And that is true. But remember, go back to 2015, Stormont agreed to a welfare mitigations package to soften the impact of the so-called bedroom tax. In other words, Stormont looked to what the British government were doing across the water and said, no, no, this is a devolved decision and we're not allowing it to happen. They didn't do it this time. Rightly or wrongly, they didn't do it. It was Stormont's decision. Gareth and Coleraine. Morning, Gareth.
Good morning, Stephen.
Gareth and Coleraine.
Good morning, Stephen. My mother's 93, Stephen. She's just £6 over the threshold. And she has to pay for everything. Now, she's housebound. She's using about £40 a week at the minute on gas, and that will increase. And she looks forward to that £100 or £300. Sorry, because of her age, she gets 300, I think. And But this year she hasn't been able to build up anything because the weather's been so bad.
So what's going to happen to her this year?
Well, it'll come down to the family, Stephen. It'll come down to us. We'll have to boost it, you know, because she uses her gas all the time. And at £1 a unit.
Why does she not get the pension credit or those other benefits that would trigger her keeping this winter fuel allowance? Why not?
Because she's £6 over the threshold, Stephen. We have tried, and it's unsuccessful every time.
And do you feel there's been enough thinking? Do you see Stormont's point? They can't magic the money from nowhere. Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, decided this for England and Wales. And essentially the way the system works is that money's then taken out of here. And unless you choose as local political parties to displace money from elsewhere to put it into that pot, you haven't got the money. Do you see their predicament, Gareth?
I understand, Stephen, their predicament. I understand it. That, you know, this word entitlement. The schools are entitled. You know, hospitals are entitled. Everybody's entitled. But the only thing is, if the winter fuel for those that are trapped in homes and that don't go into the nursing sector, if they're going to get cold or whatever, or start cutting their heating, they're going to end up in the hospitals, if you know what I mean.
Gareth, thank you. Kevin Higgins from Advice NI. So, Kevin, there's a fair percentage of people, Kevin, I think you're saying on your website, 26% of those pensioners who are entitled to the winter fuel allowance aren't claiming it. So that's an issue in itself.
Yes, Stephen, and thanks for having me on. Yes, 28%, that's in relation to pension credit. So it's important to say that winter fuel payments aren't been scrapped, but they've been means tested. So the gateway through to that now is pension credit. But of course, the huge issue with pension credit is not everybody is getting it that should be getting it. And in years gone by, there have been very important, you know, pension credit uptake campaigns that have been run by the department really, really successfully. And in my view, you know, it's time to really consider that, get the advice sector on board with this, you know, get everybody pointing in the same direction and make sure then that those people, those pensioners that really need this money, that are on the lowest incomes, are on the pension credit, number one, and they're getting that income. And then number two, that'll passport them through to get the winter fuel payment. To pick up the point, you know, that has been raised earlier around, it's around the timing of this decision and the planning and the mitigating as much as possible. Rachel Reeves made this announcement in Parliament on the 29th of July. And in my view, then, you know, the clock started ticking from then, and then we should have been all around the table looking at this. You're right to mention the welfare mitigations, and we can do things about this. Benefit cap and bedroom tax were implemented here, but under the Evison mitigations, you know, money was made available to mitigate that so that it didn't impact on our poorest households. I'm saying we can do something similar, but time is against us now, because you have to be on pension credit by about the end of September in order then, you know, to be in line to get the winter fuel payment.
Oh, do you? So the clock's ticking.
The clock is very much ticking, Stephen. This is it. We're at the start of September now, so we need to be acting really, really urgently. We need to be, you know, getting, at the very least, more awareness out about this, that, and try and allay fears of some people as well, too, that for some people, if you're on pension credit, don't worry, you'll still get the winter fuel payment. But for others, the game in town, and to try and stay ahead of the curve on this, because Labour aren't likely to backtrack, because, you know, there's such a huge majority, and they didn't backtrack on scrapping the two-child cap. So our big focus here has to be focusing on the uptake of pension credit to make sure then that as many people as possible are getting that, and then that's a passport to getting the winter fuel payment.
So what do people do?
What they need to do is contact their local advice service. There are local independent advice services across every council area. If you go onto the Advice NI website, you'll see, you know, local advice, and you can click on there. You'll see our helpline number is on there as well. So we'd be saying to people, you know, But we would also be saying to the minister and the department, Stephen, listen, why is it that I'm on saying this and trying to be proactive and trying to create, you know, answers to, you know, the real problems that people will be facing this winter? No, we need the Department for Communities officials and the minister to row in, the executive, to be fair, to row in behind this and to, you know, create a bit of momentum to try and get a bit of a silver lining out of what is, a bad news story, and let's see if we can't create a bit of good out of it.
Kevin, thank you very much indeed. Morning to you. Now, MLAs will be returning from their summer recess, as a new report is published today from the independent think tank Pivotal on their assessments of the last 7 months of Stormont have been back in business. The report indicates some progress, but no unified vision or goals. Anne Watt, Director of Pivotal, with me now. Morning to you, Anne.
Morning, Stephen.
Well, that might not be a surprise. No unified vision or goals. These are different political parties forced into this coalition.
Yeah, that's right. It's a difficult form of government to make work, but we need to see the executive working together for the good of everyone in Northern Ireland. I mean, we've got public services that are in a dire condition. We've got things like health waiting lists, access to GPs, emergency department waiting times, special educational needs places, the environment. All these things are in a really bad position and they're getting worse. And we need to see that the executive have plans in place to reverse where we are. If we just continue as we are going, we're not going to see those things improving. So we need much more unity and ambition and drive from the executive to really make a difference on the things that are affecting people in their day-to-day lives. So in our report, we do look at what's been good in the last 7 months. We talk about how the First and Deputy First Minister are working well together. The executive seems to be functioning much better than it has done at some times in the past. They've agreed a budget. They've agreed a legislative programme. But what they haven't done, and this is a real shortcoming, and I know you've talked about this on your programme, Stephen, they have not published a programme for government that says to us, here are our agreed priorities. This is what we're going to change. This is how people can expect to see improvement. So we must see that programme for government soon, which is specific about what the executive is aiming to do.
How can they put together a decent plan if they don't have, if their baseline is this country's not funded enough, they don't have enough money?
Well, there's been progress on that as well. So the finance minister has gone back to the UK government and has got a new agreement, an interim fiscal framework in the, give it its proper term, and that is an agreement that Northern Ireland will get 124% of funding per head compared to England. So Northern Ireland will get 24% more funding than in England, and that's agreed. So that is a fair funding agreement that's in place now, and what our politicians have to do is say, we've got that funding. What are we going to do about it? How are we going to use the funding that we've got, which is a fair amount, according to the Fiscal Council, compared to what England gets? How are we going to use that to improve public services here? And how are we going to make choices between doing one thing and not doing another thing?
Do they find it difficult to make choices?
I think they do find it difficult to make choices. I think there's
isn't that what government is?
Of course, government is absolutely about making choices. And I think in Northern Ireland, we haven't seen our executive making choices in the past in the way that they need to. So they've avoided difficult decisions, whether that's decisions about reform in public services, about reconfiguring the health service, or even about raising revenue in different ways. You know, they haven't made those choices which are unpopular. And actually, if you're going to do government properly, you need to face up to sometimes you can't do everything. Have to choose what are your priorities.
What we have raised last week, Anne, is the inconsistency in the likes of Paul Given, the Education Minister, saying that essentially saying he will overspend. Mike Nesbitt saying certain cuts, they won't happen in his watch. In other words, he might have to overspend. John Boucher being told off by Hugh Wittes, his permanent secretary, for overspending, and Hugh Wittes warning that he will intervene and stop it. So what government do we have? Is this a government where different departments, some will be stopped from overspending and others will carry on with it? Or what?
when you've got a budget, you have to operate within the budget. The budget is agreed by the executive, by the ministers within the executive, and the budget goes to departments, and it is their responsibility to operate within their budget. So they should not be saying they're going to overspend. If they overspend, that has implications for Northern Ireland's budget as a whole. If one department overspends, unless there's some money somewhere else that can be reallocated, that means so, Northern Ireland as a whole overspends, and the Treasury will take that money back next year. So overspending is not an option.
Let's get a quick word from commentators Kevin Maher, Alex Kane. Kevin, let's start with you. Is this executive, given the pressure on them, are they doing a good job?
I think they are in difficult circumstances. I'm just conscious that, I mean, my observation, just reading the report and then just listening to the conversation there for a couple of minutes, is that we're in danger of seeing this through Westminster-centric eyes, that you should have strong, stable government. Now, of course, everybody wants strong and stable government, but I think we need to compare the Northern Ireland executive more with, you know, Belgium or somewhere like that, where it's very difficult to put coalition governments together. Coalition governments, in the British context, they don't really work brilliantly well either. Ask Nick Clegg and the Liberal Democrats, or ask the SNP and the Greens, and their coalition, of course, fell apart last year. So I think in the context of, you know, mandatory coalition with parties that are often diametrically opposed on pretty much everything, the fact that it muddles along at all is a great achievement. And of course, however bad the record of the current incarnation of Stormont has been for the last 20 years or so, it's instantly preferable to everything that went before it, whether that's the original Stormont for 50 years or 30 years of the trouble. So we should be grateful in some respects for small mercies. We've got politics, even if it's normal for Northern Ireland.
Alex, are you optimistic about the talent and the ability of this executive?
Well, I think there is talent, Stephen, and I think that they could, if they actually got their act together, they could make some changes. But just two things which are worth saying. The first is Anne's point about the interim fiscal package, which gave it, granted the additional 24% above what applies to the rest of the United Kingdom. I've had this conversation with you before. I would not have given them. The Treasury should not have given them that extra money without being told how it was going to be spent, because we have this situation, I think Anne herself mentioned it, that they're told this money is available and then you've now worked out how you're going to do it. That's the worst way of handling things like that. You say to the government, we need it for this and this is what we will do. And another classic example is this whole thing about the winter fuel payments and Stephen. They've been back since February. They knew this was coming. We've known for the past 2 or 3 years that everyone, not just the poorest, are suffering all huge gas bills, electricity, you know, oil, all of those have gone up. We knew this was coming. We knew there would come a point this year in which a lot of people, even what they're sometimes described as the jams, the just about management, were going to be hit. And yet here we've been excited and said, oh, well, we haven't thought this through. Although my understanding is, Stephen, and I stand over this, that the headers of Jane Brady hosted, facilitated a series of meetings between the parties on many occasions in the 2 years when it wasn't meeting. My understanding was that they were actually supposed to be discussing this. Yet when it comes to concert, they asked, what decisions did you come to? Oh, we haven't. So yeah, with some broad idea,
okay. We
don't have a programme for government. If you don't have a programme for government, Stephen, you have nothing.
Alex, thank you. Kevin, thank you. And Walt, thank you. Good morning, everyone. So, yesterday a mass skinny dip took place in Port Stewart Strand. We were previewing this on Friday, weren't we? It was all to celebrate Royal National Lifeboat Institution's 200th anniversary. It was hosted by the British Naturism NI to mark their 60th anniversary. Mark Simpson was there and he is back with us this morning. Good morning to you, Mark.
Morning, Stephen.
Why didn't you take your clothes off?
Well, the bottom line, Stephen, if you pardon the pun, is I was there to do a job. I was there to report. But lots of people were asking for you. I turned up at about 12 o'clock. People had heard your debate on the show last week. And people were asking, where's Stephen? Where's Stephen?
Well, yes, I heard this reported today. Let's have a listen to this.
What about Stephen Nolan? Would he be welcome here?
Stephen would be very welcome here. I think from what he said on the radio the other morning, he enjoys being naked in his own house and the privacy of his own house. And if he was at all attracted to the idea of social nudity, he would be very, very welcome.
Well, the man that said that to you, Mark, Gary Kennedy, from British Naturism NI, with us this morning. There's a heck of a difference, Gary, from being in the nip in your own home, in the privacy of it, and being around lots of other people.
Yes, I can see where you're coming from, Stephen. Once you've done it and you realise the freedom and the health benefits of naturism, then quite often most people will just say, you know, I wish I'd done it years ago and don't know why I ever hesitated.
Mark, were there a range of age groups there or was it old wrinklies?
I would say most people there were like myself, even though I was closed, in their 50s or their 60s. Maybe one person I spotted may have been under 30. There was definitely somebody there over 80. But yeah, quite a lot of wrinkles on show.
And is it, Mark, as Gary suggests, that once there are enough people there, the shock value's gone? Is it the norm or what did it feel like for you?
Well, I was there working. So genuinely, you know what it's like, Stephen. You can't really, you know, pretend to be something other than, I mean, I had a microphone problem as well. So that's all I was fiddling with, trying to get the microphone started.
You should see your doctor about that.
But I'm not probably the best person to ask about whether the novelty wears off. I have to be honest, you know, I didn't know where to look. It was one of the hardest stories I've ever had to cover because I really didn't know where to look. I'm not sure whether novelty wears off or not.
It was embarrassing, was it?
I think it is for people like you and I that certainly in public like to wear our clothes. It was a bit of a shock, though. I have to say, in fairness to Gary and his crew, they didn't do this very publicly. It was on Port Stewart Strand, but it was towards the end of the beach. There were signs warning people, walkers, dog walkers, look, there's skinny dipping going up at the far end. If you don't want to see it, don't go there.
What are the rules of the game, Gary? Is it like the Parades Commission where you've got to get permission to walk? Have you got to get permission to do this?
Can I just, before I answer that, can I challenge Mark on his age profile? There were quite a number of people in their 30s and 40s. The majority certainly 50s and 60s. But we do have a wide, wide range of ages who participate in naturism.
Because the reason I asked that question, Gary, is I wonder if with age people become more confident. Obviously, the body deteriorates with age, but maybe confidence grows. I don't know.
Well, I think confidence grows, and certainly naturism helps body confidence. That's one of the major tenets of naturism, to help improve body confidence and body acceptance. As somebody said to me yesterday, we're all perfectly imperfect, so let's get on with it. And yes, there is that, you know, I don't care anymore attitude from some folks. You know, I'm a 50-year-old grandmother who I think Mark interviewed yesterday, and she just thought it was on her bucket list, one of those things that she should do. And she has a perfectly good body that works for her, and whether it's got lumps and bumps, she doesn't care. And that's the attitude that most people tend to bring to naturism, and certainly that's what they experience. After literally within sort of 10 or 15 minutes, you forget you're naked. And fairness to Mark, he probably felt more uncomfortable because he was clothed. If he had taken that step, he probably would have not even realised after 10 or 15 minutes that his microphone wasn't working.
Did you have a discussion in the office, Mark, whether he would wear clothes or not, or were you never going there?
I was never going there, certainly at this stage. Maybe I think there's a programme to be made. I think it's a journey, Stephen. I don't know if you know anybody at the BBC that makes really good documentary programmes. I don't know if you can think of anybody that might be able to do that.
And what about the law, Gary? What does the law say around all this stuff?
The law position is straightforward enough. It's the same right across the UK and Ireland. Public nudity is lawful as long as there is no intention to offend or shock. And the proof of offence must be made by the person offended. So, for example, the thing that, which is not naturism, but the thing that would be against the law is somebody standing on a street corner in their overcoat, and as somebody walks by, they open up the overcoat and expose their genitals. That is not naturism. That is flashing. That is illegal. However, somebody riding their bicycle in the countryside, going for a hike in the hills, skinny dipping in the sea. All of those things are perfectly lawful.
Even with so you don't need to do it in a secluded area. You don't need to get permission from the authorities.
Technically, no. Now, to keep on the right side of the PSNI, they ask us when we're doing sort of a mass skinny dip like we did yesterday, they ask us to ring 101 to advise the police call handlers that an event is taking place so that they can then, if the public ring in and say, "Oh, there's this terrible thing happening," they go, "No, it's all good. We know all about it. It's perfectly legal. Walk on by and please don't ring us again."
But are you telling me technically your understanding of the law is that you could ride your bike, for example, in the nip wherever you wanted to, as long as your motive wasn't to cause offence? Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, technically, yes. Personally, I think that's possibly a slight bridge too far, but there are a number of people right across the UK who will do this on a regular basis, and will ride their bicycles to the pub, sit in the pub naked, and have a pint, and then ride home again.
Did you know that, Mark? I didn't know.
No, I didn't.
You live and learn.
My goodness. See, you got to... Okay, well, there we go, Gary. That's you telling us that. What else do you do naked?
We have naked yoga on a regular basis. We have naked dance classes. We have camping weekends. Across British Naturism, there are a huge range of events that take place as well, from festivals to comedy nights to pub quizzes to all sorts. And we also here in Northern Ireland, we have a very close relationship with the Irish Naturist Association. We share with them the opportunity to go to swimming pools because none of the swimming pools in Northern Ireland are quite ready to cater for us yet, although we do keep asking. Certainly I was disappointed that your friend Jim Rogers didn't make it up to the beach yesterday, because I would have asked him.
So Mark Simpson, Jim Rogers copped out, did he? He chickened out. He told me he was going to go.
As I say, I didn't really know where to look, and Gary's confirmed that by saying that I probably got the age profile slightly wrong, but I didn't see Jim Rogers. I can confirm I didn't see Jim Rogers.
And is this on Newsline tonight, Mark?
No, it's not. And maybe we can put Gary on the spot on air. I mean, I was true to my word. I had to operate within certain restrictions yesterday. He spoke to his group and they said they didn't want a TV camera there. I don't know if it's too early to ask Gary about next year.
Leave it with me.
All right. Okay. Listen, thank you very much. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Gary. Nice to talk to you this morning. 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call. It's 14 minutes past 10. Because maybe. So what about all this malarkey over the weekend then, where people were queuing up for hours and hours to try to get a ticket on Ticketmaster? I was speaking to someone on Five Live that was sitting for 5 hours. They get to the top of the queue and then this automated message tells them that they are a computer bot and they get kicked off. And then another caller and another caller saying the same thing. Reg Walker, independent ticketing expert, with us this morning. Morning, Reg.
Good morning.
Good morning. So you've helped advise the teams and big stars on ticket releases. Was this respectful of the fans at the weekend, how they were treated, Reg?
I think in respect of the measures that were put in place to stop literally millions of bots attacking the system and harvesting all the tickets, there were extra layers of security put in place, which would have led to some people, especially if they were using VPNs, virtual private networks, or other identity protective telephony. That could have identified those or misidentified them as bots and kicked them out of the queue. But I think generally, if you look at the number of tickets that were sold at face value to fans, I believe it was just under 1 million tickets, which is something quite exceptional. I think that unfortunately, that fact has been missed out with the Ferrari over dynamic pricing.
Yeah, it's infuriating, obviously, for those people who it did happen to. And there is a power imbalance here, Reg, isn't there? The big promoters, the big stars, Oasis themselves, and, you know, the great unwashed trying to get a ticket. And so they're bucked off the system, some of them, when they try to get it. And then if they do get through, they're presented with this nice slushy phrase, dynamic pricing, which essentially means if the computer spots a lot of people wants the price, they will ramp it up. Now, is that just the free market, or should government intervene, as Labour have indicated they will?
I'm not sure this is what you would regard as a free market. There are structural issues within ticketing and the relationships with promoters and the ownership of some of these companies as well, which is being quite heavily investigated in the USA. And there's an argument that it should be investigated over this side of the pond as well. There's certainly a disadvantage for genuine fans trying to get tickets, because, as I say, this on sale was under attack by several million bots that the ticket companies did manage to filter out and fend off. That obviously slowed down the ability to sell tickets, which is why several people were there for several hours. If the ticket companies had just opened the floodgates, they could have sold the tickets within 15 to 20 minutes. And I very much doubt if very many genuine fans would have got a ticket at face value. They would have been forced onto these unauthorised, unethical secondary sites. So I think generally it went well. I think the issue that's taking precedent at the moment is around dynamic pricing.
Yeah, but that's the free market working, surely. I know you push back there and said it isn't, but it happens with airlines.
Actually, excuse me, it's not. You're talking about apples and lemons. In respect of airlines, hotel rooms, etc., there's surge pricing. It can happen anytime there's demand. But also, all of the rooms in that hotel or all of the seats on that airline end up surge priced or dynamically priced. What you have with ticketing is only 10 to 20% of the tickets are taken to one side and the price uplifted significantly. Now, that's not true surge pricing. That's not dynamic pricing. Otherwise, you'd be doing it for all of the tickets. All it does is it compresses the amount of affordable tickets, and that means that you've then got more touts versus more consumers for a smaller number of face value tickets, affordable tickets. And that's simply not fair. These are very, very different animals. I keep hearing this obfuscation. It happens in hotels. Well, I'm not being funny. I don't see many fans of hotels, and I don't see many fans of aircraft and airlines that are as emotionally invested in going on them or going to stay in them as you see with artists. It's simply two totally different animals.
What, therefore, do you think government should do, Reg?
I think there are two things. One is more comprehensive legislation to either place an outright ban or a cap on ticket prices altogether. I think something else as well, mandate that there must be a face value on the ticket, and that would stop the issue of dynamic pricing. And don't forget, dynamic pricing is sold to artists on the basis that it's an anti-touting measure. It's not there for anything else. This is what the ticket companies sell it to the artists as. If you get rid of ticket touting, it makes the necessity for dynamic pricing and platinum absolutely redundant. There's no need for it.
And it's the artists and the promoters who get the extra money from this so-called dynamic pricing,
right? Not necessarily the artists. The biggest beneficiaries are the ticket companies and the promoters. The promoters actually own the tickets, by the way. Let's be absolutely clear on this. The artist doesn't own them. is the promoter that owns the tickets. In respect of who benefits, if you take a ticket company selling a £100 ticket and they charge a 10% service fee, they make £10. If that price is hiked up dynamically to £300 or £400 and they still levy the same 10%, you're trebling or quadrupling your money. They're making £30 to £40 per ticket. So who do you think is pushing dynamic pricing the hardest? It's one particular ticketing company.
Really interesting. Reg, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. If any of this happened to you, 03030 80 55 55, if you were stuck in a queue over the weekend. It's winter fuel payments that you're very much wanting to talk about today. Alex is in Derry. Morning, Alex.
Good morning, Stephen. There's been an awful lot of talk about this pension care. Look, Stephen, so many people fall below the level that they can claim the other benefit. And anyway, it's an uphill struggle. I've just been speaking to somebody recently. They've spent ages trying to complete the forms, apart from anything else, and they give up. She's only 87. She says, oh, I can't get on with that. I said, well, persevere. I mean, I'm not that. She's persevered. And she said, I can't make top nor tail of it. It's not a simple question. It's not easy to do it, she's telling me. I haven't looked at it, but I haven't seen it. But at the end of the day, she says, what's the point? I'll just get on with it and see what I can do. Look, the pension can't be compared with normal salaries coming in. I mean, Stephen, no disrespect, but salaries for these many MLAs, it's quite substantial. There's an element of I'm all right, Jack, to this, I think, to some extent.
Well, they're all saying that, well, certainly Gordon Lyons and Mike Nesbitt, so the UUP and the DUP, are saying that they're very much against this decision by the Prime Minister. Now, you've heard the programming today. It's Stormont's decision.
The Treasury have given them their budget. How they spend it, Stephen, is up to them. No point going back to the Prime Minister. This is what you've got. Sort it out amongst yourselves. You've got your MLAs there. Get on with it and get your decision. There's no point in... Look, they've got the money. Look, Stephen, you've got your salary. What you do with it once you've got it is what you do with it. The BBC won't give you any more. You've got it. Get on with it.
Not for the want to try, and let me tell you. Thank you, Alex. Albert in Belfast. Morning, Albert.
Morning, Stephen. Stephen, when the parties were negotiating with the British government at Hillsborough, they knew when they walked away that they weren't getting enough money. And now they're going crying to the British government, and they're blaming the British government for making this decision. As you said, it's a devolved issue. And they have to make the decision of it. But what my question is to Gordon Lyons, what are you going to do now with Casement Park? Because you said early in the year the Casement Park basically should be allocated $60 million. Now that's the kind of money they're talking about, basically the fuel allowance. So what is he going to do? Because it would be a scandal that if he gave a penny to Casement Park, which is not needed at the minute. It's not, you know, it's not the priority at the minute. What is he going to do? And what is he going to do with the money that he's taken off the pensioners?
Well, it's Casement Park is a priority if you want it to be ready for the Euros, if you feel that Northern Ireland could showcase everything that we have to offer here in terms of introducing this as a tourist destination, and that it's a real opportunity to do so.
Yes, you said that, but I can remember on your show that somebody said that what the revenue that it would bring in would be $50 million, and what you're going to spend to actually build Casement Park is $300 million. So it doesn't work out, basically, where money is concerned. For the money that we're going to bring in.
Have a listen, because I don't know if any of you clocked this. Have a listen to what Mike Nesbitt said this morning. I think it was to Joel or Sarah on Good Morning Ulster. I can't remember who was talking to who, but certainly it's Mike Nesbitt.
Well, I was devastated, as was every member of the executive, with the decision, which came absolutely left field. Nobody here, I think, had any warning of what the government were going to do. I think there was a good collective effort to try and find some sort of workaround, but that was not possible.
There's it there.
And the fact is, oh,
there was a collective effort to get to a workaround.
But sure, the blame
what was,
the,
no, but hold on a minute. What was that workaround? We don't know. How close did they get? Were they bringing some other pensioners into the fold? How many would have been brought in? How much would it have been? Would it have cost? We don't know any of this.
The thing is, Stephen, they haven't got a programme for government, so they haven't. They haven't even sat down and worked out the money that they have, what are we going to spend it on, how much are we going to give to each basically minister.
Okay.
And Gordon Lang sat down and sought out, what am I going to do with the money that I have?
Albert, thank you. Jared and Kilkeel. Morning, Jared.
Yeah, morning, Stephen. I think what you need to do is get somebody in your office to go into any of the benefit calculators online and actually put in the figures. A couple, say a single person, as that person earlier on was saying about, and his mother was housebound. If his mother's housebound, she will guaranteed be on attendance allowance, which isn't classed as an income for pension credits. So she'd have her £218 pension credits plus £80 for the attendance allowance. Plus then there's a disability premium for living alone. It ends up, somebody in that position is quite well off. I mean, I don't think they need the money, and that's the truth.
You don't think any of the pensioners need the money?
No, the people who are on means-tested benefits do need it, yes. And if it means putting the applicable amount up by £20 a week, which gets a lot more people into that bracket, but it keeps out the people. Millionaires or even people who are relatively wealthy do not need £300 a year for oil. I mean, that's just a fact.
I think what we're seeing here is that we're seeing the start of the ramifications of an executive who so far are not prepared to raise revenue from some of us because they either want to protect us from that or they don't think it would be popular decisions for them to make as politicians. But when they do not raise money, they can't redistribute extra money that they would have raised had they have made those unpopular decisions. So there's a yin and a yang here. There are consequences from them not revenue raising. Joseph and Derry. Morning, Joseph.
Good morning to you, Stephen. Stephen, my point is, did our MLAs quiz the British government on the profits that were made by the fuel and electricity companies and gas companies over the last couple of years, that they could have been disproportionate with that of inflation? And therefore, a stealth tax should be applied. The stealth tax proceeds could then maybe help cushion those who are slightly outside of the qualification period. And let's face it, you know, somebody who's £5 or £6 outside is going to find it extremely difficult to survive this winter.
And it's those people who we are trying to represent, among others, this morning.
Yeah, absolutely,
And fight for answers as to just how much scrutiny was there by our political parties around this. They knew for a month, Joseph.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. So, as we come to the end of our programme today, it's for me to remind you how you can get in touch with us. I think you know that we grab the news by the, you know what, we fight for you to get answers and we fight for you to have a voice. So, nolan@bbc.co.uk is our email address. You can hear any of the programmes on BBC Sounds whenever you like, day or night, and I'll see you tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Thanks for your company today. Have a good day, and thank you. Bye bye.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.